Welcome to the Southern Naturalist Podcast, where we explore the interconnections of nature by providing the listeners, you, an immersive experience of what it feels like to be on the trail with us. My name is M.A. Thomas, and this is my dad, Bob Thomas.
Greetings.
We are both professors at Loyola University New Orleans and naturalists, and we're fascinated by nature and all she has to offer. We hope to encourage more people to experience the healing power of nature and develop a stronger will to protect it as our home.
We want to excite you about venturing into nature and enjoying the outdoors. Folks in the South enjoy their experiences year-round, and encounters with plants and animals vary with the seasons. We have many stories to share.
This podcast is brought to you in part by the Loyola University Center for Environmental Communication. Dive deeper into the content we cover by visiting our website at lucec.loyno.edu to learn more about this and other episodes. Hey, naturalist, welcome to another episode where we dive even deeper into the world of butterflies. Now, if you listened to our last episode, we talked all about the life cycle and natural history of butterflies with a very special focus on Gulf fritillaries and their host plants, the passion flower. Linda Auld, known in Louisiana as the Bug Lady, joined us for the last episode, and now we're headed to her butterfly shop garden to talk about monarchs, their miraculous migration, and the major threats to their population, including the unintended consequences of planting Mexican milkweed. So, Dad, let's head over to Linda's.
Hi, Linda.
Nice. Hey, Bob.
Nice to see you.
Thank you for coming to the shop in Harahan.
Of course. Hey, listen, I think our listeners would love to know more about you and how you got into this. I mean, you've got such a strong reputation of working with insects and the like. And
so my grandfather was a pioneer in beneficial insect control. Oh, and down here is our little museum of all the old bottles and concoctions that he came up with. And this is the Argentine ant poison that made him famous. It was back in 1916. The Argentine ants had come in on ships and they were all over the state. He was a field inspector. And he saw that there was a real need for the public to have a way to fight him because they were entering houses in a band a foot wide. And so there was no, there wasn't any pest control area, garden centers or any place to buy pest control at that time. And what's the cool thing about it is that those areas where he wrote about in his diary are all areas where I go butterflying. So we travel the same area 100 years later. Wow. So it's kind of cool.
So here's what I wanted to ask you. You have a place that sells products that you use to control insects.
Yeah.
Yet you're the bug lady.
Yes.
And you nurture butterflies.
Yes, I do.
Explain.
I started working in 76 for my dad on Broad Street, and I was the secretary and the bookkeeper. And so then I had to start learning the bugs because he was in 83. He says, I'm going to start thinking about retiring. So somebody had to learn the bugs, and I had never gone to college for anything, so I had to start teaching myself. So I would go out and hike and collect things and bring them in, start studying them and looking them up. And that's how I, you know, and I'm a curious person. So it always piques my curiosity to the point where I just follow through and learn about it. And so as you can see, I have a very small amount of pest control over here because I have a targeted, very select group of chemicals that I sell. The ones that I know are going to work. And when people come in, I spend a lot of time with them answering their questions and trying to stress using safety equipment and to be safe about it and using it at the right time of day so you're not going to kill bees, you know, because I'm a conservationist at heart.
So, Linda, how did you get the name Bug Lady?
Actually, my mother-in-law gave me that name when she found out that I had dead bugs in my freezer.
Okay.
So that name just kind of stuck.
Who doesn't have dead bugs in their freezer?
I don't know. But I mean, I guess my nickname would be Possum. hawks, birds,
tarantulas.
All of those are in my freezer. I tell people all the time that that I religiously go to you for help when
I have an issue in
my house, and I refer people to you all the time. But my favorite story is that I walked into your place one day, and because I had an outbreak of sugar ants. And sugar ants, for those of you that are listening, are little bitty ants, but they can get established in your house and drive you crazy.
Yep.
And they're not dangerous or anything. You usually find them in the kitchen.
Yep.
Exactly. And so I walked into Linda's place, and I said, I need to kill these ants because they're starting to spread. I'm finding them more often in my house. She said, oh, no. You don't want to kill them at all. She says, here's the game. The queen is sitting there sending out little groups foraying out looking for food. And if they don't come back, she looks around and says, hey, that team hadn't come back yet. Somebody killed them. So she starts laying eggs like crazy. So she says, here's what you need. You need this little 75-cent thing that has a little
taro ant bait.
That's right. And they walk up on the on the little slant. They take the stuff. They feed on it. They take it back to the queen and give it to her, and it kills
her. That's it. You're using the workers to do the job.
That's right.
Well, and that's understanding the natural history of that organism.
Exactly.
So that's the cool thing, and that's how it fits in here with this whole podcast, because if you understand the natural history of that particular species of ant, you can get it out of your home.
Knowledge is power.
Absolutely.
That's right. And really what Linda has done throughout her career is she spent more time learning the natural history of the things that everybody loves and figuring out how to nurture them, and then also
observation,
but also how to get people to do it at their own homes.
That's right. I try to listen to their problem and find out exactly what the situation is, to identify it. You know, that's the first step, is identify the pest.
Yep.
Because you have to know the life cycle in order to know what to use or how often to use or where to spray. So it's very important to know what you're doing.
So how did your, I'm just curious about this, since you're in pest control, but yet you love all these, you are the bug lady. How did your opinion on pest control change after you started studying the insects? Or did it? I don't want to lead you saying that it changed, but tell us about that.
When I first started working for my dad, we were just selling pest control, and I didn't really know that much about it. I started off as the secretary and the bookkeeper.
And so, it was just the family business.
That's the family business.
Okay.
And so as I, part of our business was to identify bugs that people bring in so that we can help them to solve their pest problem. And first step is identify what it is.
Well, and that's first step of a naturalist, too. When we're looking at something, what is it
at? And I'm not college trained, so I decided, well, I'm going to start teaching myself.
Yep.
So that was hiking and going out and collecting and bringing it back and looking it up. You see, back then you didn't have iNaturalist where you could just take a picture. You had to go find a book.
Or Seek, the app that helps you identify things
in real time.
That's right.
It's so easy now.
Yeah.
I mean, in fact, the last time we were at Pearl River, it was the first time I had two of the folks with me with their phones taking pictures of things, trying to identify what they were. And I was like, this is a first.
Yep.
Everybody loves monarchs, and part of that is because they've gotten so much visibility over the years. First, just because they're gorgeous butterflies, and then because they were imperiled, because the populations were dropping and people were starting to speculate on why that happens. But they have a huge distribution. They go all the way from southern Canada and then spend their winters in largely in Mexico.
Yes.
In the mountains in Michoacan. And but then they're a little... As in all distributions of animals, little wings that go off here and there. There's some on the other side of the Rocky Mountains in California and the like. And so people are totally enamored with them, and we know that.
Yes.
Let's talk for a minute about the life cycle of monarchs. Is it the same as fritillaries and other butterflies?
Well, it's a four stage, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they're going to be on milkweed.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got the egg, the caterpillar, and it eats, poops, and grows, and then it eats, poops, and grows. It's just pretty much its whole life. And it molts four or five times, And then at a particular time, it's like, okay, I'm ready to stop eating now, and I'm going to make a chrysalis. And it can find the craziest place to make this. Sometimes I'll see it on a bird bath, a windowsill, and I think to myself, really? That's the most perfect spot?
Right.
Well, but the chrysalis is beautiful. It's green, and it has the gold dots.
Oh, it's
and
gorgeous.
Of course, those are all the colors in the bug world that say, I taste bad.
Yep.
Leave me alone.
They eat, of course, in the larval stage mostly, and they're only eating
milkweed.
Only milkweed. Okay,
but they'll eat any kind of milkweed.
Any kind of milkweed. Okay, so it just depends on the milkweed that's present that they can find. And there's what's in the milkweed that then makes them toxic when they become adults?
Carotenoids. And unfortunately, the tropical milkweed has high levels of that. And that's why most of the monarchs choose that, because they think that it's going to help the caterpillar in its defense against predators.
So we mentioned in the last episode that there are nectar-visiting plants and egg-laying plants. And so just to recap and make sure that our audience remembers the difference, Linda, tell us a little bit and make it specific to monarchs, since we're talking about monarchs here.
I've seen monarchs use a variety of nectar plants in my yard. They seem to like the dianthus, which is easy to grow, lantana, that's just about anywhere. But there's so many different things that you can choose from. So basically, you choose what you would like to see in your yard and just see what they're going to use, because I've never seen two gardens that are the same.
Yeah.
So you're going to try different things.
And that's just for the adults.
That's right. This is for the adult butterfly. They have that straw-like tongue, and they want to siphon the nectar and pollen from the plants.
Okay.
But milkweed is a dual purpose, because the flowers provide nectar also. So the leaves provide the nourishment for the caterpillars to eat the leaves, but then it also has the nectar and the flowers for the adult.
Okay. Will the caterpillars eat the stem and the flowers as well?
They can.
If there aren't any leaves.
If they're really desperate, right, they'll eat just about anything down to a nub.
Let's talk just a minute about migration, and tell us about their migration pattern, and then how they, you know, how you can watch this. Maybe in the spring is usually the better time to watch it in New Orleans.
In the spring, they come from Mexico, and most of the monarchs are going to fly straight north up through Texas and through the Midwest and head towards Canada.
Right. So it's several generations of these butterflies that are making the journey from Mexico into the United States and then all the way up to Canada in some cases.
In the fall, they have gone down to Mexico. They've been hibernating those winter months down there, and it's diapause. They're not mating. They're just hanging out. And then at a certain particular time, they all decide that they're going to come back. And there's so many that it takes about 6 weeks for them to clear out. And as they come up, it's very important that when they reach the shores over in southern Louisiana, that we do have milkweed, because these are the healthy monarchs that we want to raise their babies, because we know that they could not have made that journey if they were sick.
So, question, are monarchs the only butterflies that we have in North America that have those migration patterns that are that large and distant?
That are that large, yes. But other butterflies do migrate. I mean, I see sulfurs in certain parts of the state in certain times of the year, and they're not here. And also pipevine swallowtails, I've seen them along the coastline. So there are other butterflies. I mean, certain types of butterflies can have other diseases, and so they're trying to outrun those by going into new sections and starting new colonies.
Sort of like birds that get up and leave a big roost because the fleas get too thick.
I guess that applies all across the board.
Right.
So, Linda,
self-preservation.
Right. Yeah. How do these monarchs know how to migrate? I mean, do they use the same mechanism that a bird would use? Because we there's a lot of studies that have been done on birds and their mm-hmm. migration patterns.
Mm-hmm. Well, they go with the wind.
Okay.
And they say also the magnetic poles.
Mm-hmm. So essentially, it's like any migratory organism. They're following the path of least resistance, where they're going to get the most food. They're going to find their mates. It's going to be a nicer seasonality or season at the time.
Okay. Right. Exactly.
All right. So it's complex, but there's a pattern there. It's recognizable.
There is, but it seems like it's different every year.
Yeah, of course.
Just to clarify, I want everybody to know that when birds migrate, it's the same individual that's going from, you know, a northern to a southern and then a southern to a northern location. With these insects, it is several successive generations, not the same individual, the same genetics, the same genes, but it is just truly amazing that it is several generations of a monarch that are making this trek.
Let's talk for a minute about how our knowledge has expanded rapidly over the last decade. Because I remember that when I was really getting into these things, if I wanted to have them in my yard, I had to have Mexican milkweed. And so it didn't take me long to find it. Everybody was selling it. Let's talk about how we've changed our opinions on Mexican milkweed.
For the last 5 years, Jenna Hoff and I have been closely working with Dr. Kristen Steele of Tulane University. She was working on her thesis about the OE parasite. It's a protozoan spore that is passed by the butterflies. The butterflies are the carriers. The spores are, when the male and female are mating, the spores are swapped back and forth, and then they carry them. And when they visit plants to get nectar off the flowers, these spores are spread. When the female lays eggs on the plant, the spores are on the egg, and the first thing that the caterpillar eats is the eggshell. So then it's infected.
It gets into the intestines of the butterfly?
It distorts their gut.
Oh, okay.
Our New Orleans area is very unique. It's similar to the southern Florida, where we are a hot spot for the OE parasite. When, in 2013, when Monarch Watch reported that it was the lowest number in recorded history, it shook up people. It became national news. It was the main topic every time you turned on the television. And so it was in the public eye. And everybody's like, well, you know, I think it's human nature that we want to help nature most of the time. So everybody decided, okay, I'm going to buy milkweed and put it in my yard. But the problem is monarchs are complicated. And the more that we have been studying it, it just seems like it's getting more complicated. If the tropical milkweed was native to this area, we'd be seeing it growing everywhere. I've never seen it on a trail. It's only in gardens where we put it.
Right. Okay, so for the listeners, the tropical milkweed, if you Google that, you'll find pictures of it. And it's probably the milkweed that you've mostly seen. If you haven't, I guess, been in tune or aware of the push in our area to plant native species. So what's the species name of tropical milkweed? The flower itself is a combination of reds and yellows and oranges. Is it Asclepias?
Asclepias curassavica.
Okay.
But the one that is native to our area is the aquatic milkweed.
Yes.
Which is the Asclepias perennis, which has a white flower. The difference is that the native species is very slow growing. The aquatic has been here since 1890. There's a specimen at the Tulane Herbarium which proves that it's been here. That is our native milkweed. When I'm at Honey Island Swamp or Bunny Corray Spillway, that's what you see. And so when the first caterpillars eat it down, it takes a long time for it to come back. And also, when it grows in its natural habitat, the other grasses and other plants that are around it grow much higher because it's a small plant, so you can't find it. So, I mean, I was shocked when I read Charles Allen's article that there are 20 kinds of native milkweeds in Louisiana. I said, what?
Yeah.
How did I not know this?
Right.
No one was selling it. You know, the garden centers sell the tropical because it's easy to grow. They know that There are people that want to buy it. So it's cash.
Mm-hmm.
It's a money thing. So, but I think they're finally, after all these years of talking about the native plants, they're finally seeing that it is a good retail item, and they're starting to stock it because more people are requesting it.
Right.
And so what is the connection then with having this OE parasite and planting the tropical milkweed? Does the tropical milkweed have something to do with it? Or is it that the tropical milkweed is blooming and it's different than our native species? So it's giving the monarchs a different, you know, span of their life cycle and stages of their life.
When the monarchs are flying south in fall, they shouldn't be laying eggs. They should be just going to Mexico. But when they see all this tropical milkweed that we've put in our gardens, they're like, hey, we're in Mexico. Let's make babies. So that's why we are stuck with this non-migratory monarch population whose Kristen Steele has proven that in our area gets over 90%. So we're only raising sick butterflies. And they can look perfectly fine. So that's why this sampling program is so important for our area. It's been proven through scientific study that the caterpillars that eat tropical milkweed develop smaller wings, so they can't get to Mexico.
Okay.
It's also been proven that if it gets over 80 degrees, they can't do long-distance flight because it's too hot. So those two factors in our area mean that they're stuck here. And the fact that the tropical milkweed regenerates its leaves so fast, it enables them to repeatedly use it. And that's what helps the parasite
to
thrive.
They stay here instead of going to Mexico
exactly.
Is the problem. Okay.
So basically, we should be raising monarchs in the spring. So June 1st, in our area, I'm not talking about the whole state, in our area, we need to cut the milkweed down. Or dig it up, put it in a pot in your greenhouse until spring, or put nets over it. Take a tomato cage, put some netting, so that if there are a few caterpillars left on there, they can finish what they're doing, but then more butterflies can't egg bomb it.
Tell us about the citizen science work you're doing right now with monarchs.
This year, Jenna Hoff and Kristen Steele and I decided that we were going to help promote this OE information by doing the Monarch Citizen Science 2022 project. So we're trying to get a bigger understanding of how far does this really reach. And so these ladies have been doing this process of raising and sampling and also catching wild ones and testing them, and sadly this year they're already having some that are sick. Our area is real important to be testing because we're the hot spot. So the four signs that would let you know that you have a problem would be, the first thing is that when the monarch caterpillar is ready to make its chrysalis and hangs in that J formation, that it does not finish its pupation, and it looks like it's just wearing a green helmet.
Okay. So it doesn't completely enclose
it
itself in
the complete pupa, right.
Okay.
The second thing is that it would make it the pupa, but it would turn black and never hatch. The third thing is that the butterfly tries to emerge, but is stuck in the pupal case. The fourth thing is that it hatches, but its wings are all deformed.
So they never completely unfurl and become. So you would know when you look at a monarch when it's infested
sometimes,
with
OE. Sometimes it looks perfectly fine, but it's a carrier.
Okay.
So that's why the OE sampling is so important.
All right. Well, tell us about that. What do you mean the OE sampling?
That is a program through the University of Georgia. You can Google Project Monarch Health and see their website. You can see pictures of all this I just described and get a whole lot more information about the parasite and how it is so horrible. But you see, not everybody in our state has this problem, but we do in our area. And the sampling, it's real easy to do. You contact the University of Georgia. They send you a kit, And they have all the instructions on there of how to do it, but basically you're holding the butterfly with the wings down and you're looking at its abdomen, and you take a piece of tape and you rub it over the abdomen and you collect the spores, and then you put that on a post, little note card, clear white note card, and look under the microscope. And you'll see on the website, it gives you clear pictures of what you're looking for. Under the microscope, you'll see larger images, and those are the scales of the butterfly. As you're taking the sample, some of the scales will come off, but it doesn't hurt the butterfly to do that.
We mentioned before that the name Lepidoptera, which is the order they belong to, means scaly wing. So that's what Linda's talking about. When you take the tape off, you're going to see some of the scales, but what you're looking for, and when she mentioned just a minute ago that you can just Google Project Monarch Health, I'm doing that right now, and I can see everything that she's talking about on this website. So y'all can all Google it and start looking at it, and it shows you, gives you a search image for what you should be seeing.
What you're looking for is that it looks like pepper, and those are the spores. You know, sometimes you only see a couple, some are heavily infected. So these are, and you can get microscopes, a little handheld microscopes for $15-$20, and they can let you see what's happening. And this is so important for people who are raising a lot of these at home, because if you decide that you're going to continue to do that, you need to go through certain protocol. And before you release them, you must test them, because if you don't, you could just be spreading this further.
It's all about surveying for OE and monarchs.
Sampling.
That's what your project is, just sampling.
Yes.
Trying to figure out, where is this hotbed of
how
OE?
Bad is this level in our area? And Kristen has even discovered that in winters where we have cold winters and the tropical milkweed dies down, her studies have proven that by fall, the levels are just as high as if we had had no cold winter at all, which is kind of depressing. Mm-hmm. That it's here. And the fact that we have gotten all this milkweed, it really has just made the problem worse. But the garden centers still keep selling it.
Yep. Well, that's why I called it an unintended consequence, because nobody meant for anything negative to happen. We were trying to help out, and yet now we're learning this. So, you know, this is what science is. As we learn more and more through the studying, in this case, studying the OE parasite in the monarchs, we have to take the new data and we have to change our mantra. You know, before we thought, let's plant more so that we can harbor more and raise more of these monarchs. But now we're realizing that's having a bad consequence. All right, Linda, so tell us about the Monarch Way Station gardens. What are they, and if any, you know, tell us how to make one or get one.
The Monarch Way Stations are actually a fueling stop for monarchs during their migration.
Okay, so the Way Station is the fueling. Okay, so it's plants.
That's right, and it's sponsored through Monarch Watch. You can go on their website and get all the information of what you need to plant, and then if you want to certify your yard, you fill out the form, get the sign. But basically, you're going to need lots of milkweed, because you're in the spring. You are feeding the caterpillars the healthy generation coming from Mexico. And then you want to have plenty of nectar plants, because they need to fuel up. So a good variety of blooming plants and milkweed. I've been trying to encourage people to focus on other local butterflies and try to get them away from, you know, focusing on the monarchs. Because we have about, I don't know, over 30 different species here in our area that they could be enjoying in their yards if they just have the specific caterpillar host plants. if they could just change their focus to these other butterflies that don't have all these issues.
Okay, so tell us, let's say, five butterflies that we could, you know, with a simple certain plant, we could put in our yards that we could attract and really enjoy.
Well, right now, black swallowtail is number one.
Okay.
You know, because all you need is parsley, dill, fennel, rue, Queen Anne's lace.
Yep.
I mean, I've got over 40 caterpillars right now.
Yep, I do too.
And,
I love them.
You know, of course, my friend says, you could leave them outside. But then, you know, most of them aren't going to make it. They're
right.
going to be just part of the food chain.
Yep, the birds
so
are going to
So I enjoy sharing them with other people. But all the swallowtails, you've got...
Okay.
The Gulf Fritillary.
Okay, Gulf Fritillary.
Gulf Fritillary is an easy one. Cloudless Sulfur.
Ooh.
All you need is some partridge pea. Partridge pea is just a wonderful plant. If you come to my shop, you're going to see it in full majestic beauty in my front flower bed.
And that's a vine, right? Is that a vine?
It's an annual plant.
Okay.
And it attracts, I've seen over six species of bees and wasps on it.
Cool.
So it's a great pollinator plant, but it's also the caterpillar host plant for Cloudless Sulfur, Sleepy Orange, and Little Sulfur. Three butterflies, and actually I've seen all three of those in my yard laying eggs on the partridge pea. So those are really easy.
Yeah. I have a question. In our last episode where we were talking about Gulf Fritillaries and Passion Flower, you mentioned in one of your descriptions and discussions about going out and doing these surveys.
It's the North American Butterfly Association, and they started the counting in 1975. And I go to the Pearl River, Honey Island Swamp. We go five times a year. It's been going on, this is year 47.
Oh, wow.
So it's a huge database of information, and we've seen over almost 80 species of butterflies because we go in different seasons to see different species of butterflies.
But the same habitat every time?
That's right.
Location.
We use the same trails, and the way it works is you hike, and whatever you see, you write it down. So at the end of the field trip, you have documented what you've seen, and this information is sent to NABBA. And each year they produce a report, and there's over 500 counts done nationwide in Mexico and Canada. So we're not the only ones doing it out there. And this information is very important because it helps you study the fluctuation of butterfly populations and better understand environmental change.
Okay. And so if anybody wanted to join in some of these counts, they can go to NABBA.org?
That's right. Okay. We're Region 10.
That's really cool. Okay. If you haven't seen the Bug Lady's book called Butterfly Summer, you need to go out and get it. You can buy it at her store. And
where
else?
Online.
Or online. Very good. I have a signed copy. You all need to get a signed copy. It's great. So her book that came out 3 years ago talks about her summer exploring butterflies.
Some of them are discoveries in my garden. Some of them are on field trips. And a whole chapter is about Charles Allen.
Okay.
He's got a wonderful place in Pitkin, Louisiana.
There you go. We've talked about Charles on a previous episode. That's great. And they have lots of really good photos in here. So it could be your own field guide as well.
Good. And it's local. These are all local butterflies. Each beginning in the chapter is the life cycle. So you know what you're looking for. But you're getting that in your brain.
Yes.
So the next time you're hiking, you can amaze all your friends and you can say, look, I know what that is.
Love it. Well, thank you so much for coming into the studio, allowing us to come to your shop and talking to us. And thanks to everyone who's been listening for joining us and learning about monarchs and learning about the Bug Lady. We hope you're more inspired to get outside. We always say that. So get outside, start searching for butterflies and supporting them in your own yard. And don't forget to subscribe to this podcast and write a review if you enjoyed it. And find more information about the species we found and more resources for naturalists by following us on social media and our website, lucec.loyno.edu. Thank you to our Loyola intern, Kitty Pearlsweig, and this episode was produced by Emma Reed. Until next time.